And I'm fucking livid that we are stuck in the timeline where Alex Jones is right.
Kind of worse.
Oh no! Oh, okay, no.
Why aren't the Amish afraid of COVID? Because they don't have TVs.
As I said, democracy is a system that reinforces authoritarian ideals.
I hope I don't get canceled. Talk to Steve.
Being a victim of a tragedy doesn't make you an expert in public policy.
Well, I mean, AOC is a drama queen and she's full of shit.
Remember, they lost the Afghan war 10 years ago.
You brought a freaking guillotine.
They said, you don't get to tell us no. We're the state health department. And I said, hell no.
It wasn't making Christianity better. It was making rock worse.
What the fuck do you have on your face, Olivia?
You want to make the world a better place? Have some babies and raise them to not be stupid.
Remember thinking, man, governments are not going to like this shit.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, activists, shitposters of all stripes, anarchists, libertarians, Republicans, whoever the heck you are, the people of the internet, thank you for taking the time out of your day to tune in and listen to another episode of O'Donnell for Liberty. As always, I'm your host, Justin. And before we get started, just remember, whatever platform you listen on, whether YouTube Live, Odyssey, Spotify, Apple Podcast, Anchor, or on the air at LRN.FM on a couple radio stations nationwide, you can help grow the show by liking, commenting, subscribing, and most of all, sharing the content with your friends. If you enjoy the content, you can join the production team by visiting patreon.com/O'Donnell for Liberty. Again, that's patreon.com/O'Donnell4Liberty. And make sure to always check out our sponsor, SnackSwag.com, for all your favorite Liberty merch. They've got some fantastic designs on t-shirts, tote bags, coffee mugs, sweatshirts, all your favorite Liberty gear, Liberty merch. You can go wear your message, brag, and proselytize to your friends and to the greater public. Because if you're willing to say it, you might as well be willing to wear it. And that is how we make Liberty win. With culture and art, and most of all, wearing our message, literally, on our sleeves. If you want to keep in touch between shows, make sure you head over to the Discord and join the community Discord. The links are in the description of the video, podcast, or radio stream you're listening to. Or you can head over to O'Donnell4Liberty.com for the links to join the Discord channel. Great community, great friends of the show, and chat with other fans of the show at any time. Now, what are we talking about today? There's a lot in the news. There's a lot going on, and there's a lot to keep us down as libertarians, but give us a reason to push forward and a reason to move forward. And just in the news in the past 24 hours, we've seen crazy things like Canada declaring martial law over protests and people exercising their freedom of speech and demanding a redress of their grievances to the government. We've seen conflicting news reports from mainstream media outlets banging and beating the drums of war, trying to encourage Americans to support war with Russia. Just this morning, Fox News and CNBC were reporting that Russian troops were staging for an imminent attack on the Ukraine, while at the same time, Sky News and Al Jazeera were reporting that the same Russian troops were finishing their annual winter training exercise off the Ukrainian border and were heading home. Which one is true? We don't know. It's up to the news to inform us, but the news clearly has an agenda. And what is that agenda, if anything, but distraction? And what's it distracting us from? Is the important part, because with all of the chaos and the beating of drums of war here, abroad, our neighbors in Canada, our allies in Europe, it's distracting us from the fact that we have an ever-present threat of tyranny right here at home, right here in the supposed freest country in the world, in the United States of America. What are we to do about it? And if you look at America, where Canada is ranked the freest and least free states, California, our most populous state in the United States, our most represented state in the United States, our least free state in the United States. What's a libertarian to do in California? With tyranny around every corner, government growing with every breath. Nicholas Wildstar is running for governor, trying to bring libertarianism back to the representation of the people of California. Nick, thanks for joining the show tonight. How are you?
Fantastic, brother. Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here to speak with you.
As always, I always try and ask people the same like kind of series of questions, especially when having someone like yourself on your show, on my show. Like, I'm really hyper focused on people's path to liberty and the work they're doing to advance liberty in their lifetimes and make the world a better place. What was your libertarian moment? And I don't mean the moment that made you a libertarian, because I don't believe anybody really has that. I don't believe anybody has a moment that just makes them say, oh, I was fucking wrong, I'm a libertarian. It's a series, like Jim Bouchard of Maine wrote a book called Crazy Angry Libertarian. The whole point of his book was he doesn't think anybody can ever become a libertarian. You always were a libertarian your whole life. It's fundamental about your personality, your values, and your core beliefs, where you always were a libertarian. But it sometimes takes a series of events or a building series of events to make somebody realize that they always were a libertarian. What was your path to liberty, and how did you get to where you are today?
Well, I believe that statement is definitely true. We are all libertarians here in America, despite whatever our political party preference may be, or whatever political ideology. You know, at the heart of being an American is libertarianism. I mean, even at a young age, when I got my first job and my first paycheck, and I look at it and I'm like, why
am I taxes? What the hell are these?
You know, and my employer had to explain to me, well, everybody pays taxes, they take the money. I'm like, well, why? I mean, what do I get from it? I'm 14, you know. But yeah, so I would say as an adult, every step of the way, just leading up until then, you know, joining the workforce after high school and all of that, just seeing the effects that the government had on my own personal life and restricting my own freedoms. You know, here I am in California, in a state where, you know, cannabis is legal. Back then, when I moved to California, it was in 1999, but yeah, I mean, California already had existing laws on the book that allowed an individual to exercise that right. Where I came from, Wisconsin, that didn't exist, you know, so that was already liberating for me, coming from such a restrictive environment, you know. But I would say the moment that, I guess, put me in a direction towards voting libertarian and finding out more about what the Libertarian Party had to offer was the 2008 election, when Obama got elected. You know, I was a Democrat hopeful, you know, black man. I'm like, yeah, let's do this, man. Let's bring down the system, especially when he's talking about, you know, getting money out of politics and the devastation that Wall Street has done on our economy. You know, it's like, it doesn't take a genius to realize, you know, what these people are doing with our money, the Federal Reserve System and, you know, fiat currencies, et cetera. But
it's wild to me, because Obama, I was actually fully aboard Team Obama back then, believe it or not.
So was I. Yeah.
And the weird part was, for me, it was like, it was shortly after I joined the military, and I started to get disenfranchised real quick after joining the military. It's like, oh, this actually kind of sucks. And Obama campaigned on being the end of the wars, close Guantanamo Bay, bring back the troops. I'm like, yeah, that sounds a little bit more stable. Like, I'll vote for that. That sounds better. And then, like, 3 months after he got elected, people in my army unit were getting orders to go to Guantanamo Bay. I'm like, I thought that shit was closed.
Right. Yeah.
Like,
next thing you know, he's sending more troops to Afghanistan. Yeah. And it was just a reverse, you know, it was more of the same, only a Democrat was wearing it. I mean, I think it was even stated that he actually pushed more of Bush's policies than Bush did, you know. Just drone strikes, he kicked that up a notch. I mean, the debt definitely just sent it skyrocketing. And that's what really pissed me off, is because as soon as he got elected, he took a $500,000 check from Goldman Sachs. He bailed out the banks. He bailed out the Sallie Mae, Freddie Mac. And he was the one that coined the whole too big to fail statement. So while we talk about it, people got to remember, Obama was the one that made this this country, this economy, prop up every damn corporate industry, starting with the banking industry, you know. And as soon as that happened, I knew that he was a sellout. You know, I was like, I'm done. I'll never vote for another Democrat again in my life, you know. But I was like, I'll never vote for a fucking Republican either, unless they actually put up one
right
I can agree with, you know. And so far, everyone that they kind of put up was not one that I agreed with, but one Republican did, Dr. Ron Paul. And the more I learned about him, I was like, okay, I think I found my guy, you know? So in 2012, I was actually campaigning for Dr. Ron Paul. I flew out to Tampa for the convention out there to rally for him. I even joined the party, the Republican Party, so I could vote for him. You know, I wasn't an active member of the party, so I couldn't be a delegate or anything like that, because, you know, they have their guidelines. You have to be a member for a year, et cetera, and all of this stuff. So I knew just the path to becoming a delegate would have been difficult for me. But I was an Occupy Wall Street protester, Occupy protester out here in California. And Ron Paul was my guy. So after I learned about ending the Fed, pretty much that was his rallying cry out in the streets. You know, Occupy protesters was carrying signs that say end the Fed, you know? Yeah. So it's ironic that those same damn people are now on the burning train, you know?
Well, some, like, some of them woke up and some of them read it. So, like, I live here in New Hampshire, and the community I live in is largely populated by Free Staters, people who moved for the Free State Project, who ardent libertarians who believed in the mission of libertarian consolidation and taking over a state to proving concept. Like, if we take over a state government, we can make it libertarian and give a proof of concept that libertarian ideas work. But it's not its entirety. We've had about 6,000 movers and people we can definitively say are Free Staters. I'm not even counted in that number because I didn't move for the Free State Project. I moved for work. Like, I moved from Massachusetts to New Hampshire to reduce my commute and met this great community of people up here. But we also have a whole bunch of Occupy people who were met during that Occupy movement, who the Ron Paul Revolution folks managed to swing over and get on board with libertarianism, and now there's some of our most ardent libertarians who came from that sector. Did I lose you, Nick? Hold on. Hey, so it looks like we lost Nick. Give me a second. We're going to pop him out. Nick, rejoin if you can in the meantime. But to just talk about that, like, the path to liberty is different for everybody, and for a lot of people, the path to liberty was Occupy Wall Street, which is something that we find mind-numbingly difficult to understand for a lot of libertarians. The people can't come from the left and embrace values of true liberty and true freedom, especially people coming from the left, from the Occupy movement, who now embrace the values of Austrian economics and economic freedom and human liberty. So it's something that we really do need to grasp that there are people from every side and every facet of the walk of human life that come to the liberty movement. And Nick, when he gets back here, I want to ask him all about how he met those people, how he fundamentally interacted with those people, because they approach things so differently. And I hear stories from a lot of my friends who were at Occupy as libertarians and how the progressives had just such a different and wildly different culture, but wanted the same things. And that's one of the things I think that we as libertarians, when we're running for office like Nick does and Nick is doing, fail to do is realize there's a lot of people who share our ideas, a lot of people who want to accomplish the same things that we as libertarians want to accomplish. They just have a different path in how they want to accomplish it. They have different ideas of how they want to accomplish it. They want to work towards equity rather than equality, even though the outcome that they envision is equality. They want to look towards regulation to eliminate the evils of capitalism rather than deregulation to free the market to overcome the burdens of of monopoly. Because the goals in the end result is peaceable, consent-based, voluntary, and mutual exchange. But the path to accomplishing that is the only point of disagreement. And what was accomplished in bringing a lot of the Occupy people over to the liberty movement here in New Hampshire and New England with Occupy Boston and Occupy Wall Street so close, was recognizing that that path could work together and could necessitate a positive change for people, and that by getting over our differences in strategy, we could agree on outcomes and work independently of each other up until the point it conflicted. And when it did conflict, we've formed a relationship with these people where we're able to then move forward in peaceful discussion and debate and not even a non-argumentative manner to work together with people. And that brings them over, and that wins them over, and that gets them onto your side. So let me just shoot Nick. I just shot Nick a message. We're going to get Nick back on when Nick can get back on. I think he might be having some internet difficulties, or we may be having some internet difficulties. But if you are tuned in for the last episode I did, you know how bad the internet got, and Comcast did fix it. So we'll move forward. Now, for those of you, until we get Nick back, let's just bring up Nick's website, because this is what I wanted to bring Nick on to talk to you guys about tonight. This is where I think the path to liberty may stand, is check out Wildstar 2022. You can learn about Nick's campaign. You can learn about what he's working towards, learn about what he's working for, and you can get involved, get information, maybe learn. Maybe you're not fully on board with a libertarian running for governor of California. Maybe you're really not on board with a libertarian running as a Republican for the governor of California. Nick, you back?
Yes. I apologize. I have technical difficulties. My computer restarted on me. The government heard me talking about the.
It's always the government.
The next thing you know.
No worries. I was regaling the audience with the, for those of them, for everyone who tuned into the last episode where I had Tony DiRazio of New York on, I felt the same way. I thought the government was trying to stop us from talking, but it turns out it was just Comcast, not the government. So honestly, Comcast might be a bigger evil than the government. So Comcast,
and they do have the government in their pocket. So
they're granted a local service monopoly by the government. And to me,
right.
Back to your comments about Occupy. I had mentioned everyone while you were away. I think Occupy and libertarians were destined to be bedfellows from the very beginning, because what Occupy saw as the fight that needed to be had is the fight that libertarians have been fighting for generations. We all agreed on the outcome, and the outcome was a market based on consent, voluntary and mutual exchange. We just disagreed on the path towards that. Whereas we wanted deregulation and more free markets, they wanted more regulation and the crushing of monopolies and corporations.
Exactly. Yeah, so I mean, who's there?
So your cell may be losing signal there, Nick.
What's that? Now your cell is being interrupted.
Hold on a quick second.
Oh, my, and they're called Spectrum because Time Warner took over.
Yeah, so the cable monopoly.
You still with me?
I'm with you.
I'm with you.
All right. Up a little bit on
I got us. You. Man. Okay.
So, so the cable monopolies are a big thing to me, and they're a big indication of how our economic structures have incentivized a perversion of capitalism to be away from what any libertarian would define as capitalism or free market-based economics, where government has granted service monopolies to private companies, where you have Comcast, who operates in large swaths of the area, Verizon operates in large swaths of territory with zero competition, and the government has decreed that they have a service monopoly in that area. So they treat their employees like shit. They treat their customers like shit. They charge outrageous prices, and they don't allow for competition. And I think that perversion of capitalism is no longer a free market capitalism. It is strictly fascism and tyranny.
Yeah. I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, that's what's happened pretty much all across the country, thanks to these zoning laws. You know, it's granted territories for these corporations to pretty much dominate. I mean, I remember using Clear, which I guess was a subsidiary of Sprint. And I loved their service. It was like $25 a month, man, and unlimited internet use. And I mean, it was like the best ISP service out there, pretty much in the area. But I don't know what happened, but since they were using Sprint's towers, they ended up having them phased out and took over the territory, just like AT&T, just like Verizon. You know, it muscles out the smaller guys. So how does it leave open the opportunity for, you know, some of these smaller companies that want to have an opportunity to grow? I mean, I'm surprised Metro PCS made it as far as it did, because, you know, what's that?
Metro PCS is owned by Sprint. Metro PCS is one of Sprint's subsidiaries that markets itself as a cheaper alternative that specifically markets to disadvantaged minority communities as saying they're the alternative for people who are lower income and can't afford the service of Sprint. But at the same time, it's just Sprint. And Sprint has found a way to capture another market share with the exact same product just by rebranding it and charging a little bit less. Straight Talk does the exact same thing. They're Verizon. Cricket has done the exact same thing. They're AT&T.
Yeah, these guys are smart. I mean, who can blame them, though, when it comes to a business decision? If the smaller businesses is pulling in as much, a certain number of customers that you were never attracting with the products you provided, then why not, you know, provide them with an offer that they can't refuse? And it happens all the time in the tech industry. We see it happening, you know, with Facebook pretty much buying up every smaller competitor. But I think that's just the way of business. What ties our hands as a consumer is when they get involved with policy creation, you know, and having the supposed public representatives do their bidding, you know, to create this monopolization on an industry. So it's happened with cannabis as well. It's happened pretty much with everything, the automobile industry, you know. So if we really do want to live in a free state, in a free market economy, then we have to look at those policies that are preventing innovation. And I believe you wanted to talk about my Phoenix initiative before.
Absolutely.
And the goal of that is to get rid of those restrictive policies like occupational licenses. You know, it makes no sense for someone that's doing, cutting your grass to have to obtain, you know, a license to do so, or cutting your trees or cutting your hair. You know, it makes no sense whatsoever, especially when the people that are usually in those industries that have the best skills to provide were professionals their entire lives. You know, some of them were born into it and have been doing it longer than they ever had the license. So it's really just a piece of paper, and it prevents, again, smaller businesses from having the opportunity to be developed, especially when they got to obtain a license just to be in business. I mean, it's ridiculous.
So one of the craziest things to me about COVID and how COVID just absolutely wrecked and destroyed the economy for 2 years, put hundreds of thousands of people out of work, people desperate, couldn't make rent, couldn't make paychecks, and just shuttered businesses left and right, is that when lawmakers in Congress started to brainstorm on how they could incentivize a economic comeback to save us from COVID and to fix COVID, a lot of their responses was, we're going to temporarily get rid of some regulations. We're going to temporarily rescind some of these licensing requirements. We're going to make it easier to do these business practices temporarily until the economy is recovered. And libertarians and conservatives, and even a lot of progressive liberals who hated monopoly and big government and big corporate structures, hopped on the trend of like, fuck, make it permanent. Like, why are we doing this temporarily? If everyone can agree that these changes are good for people, good for business, and good for the economy, why are we saying from the get-go it's temporary?
Exactly. I mean, one of the biggest, I guess, shockers of that here in the state was allowing businesses to deliver alcohol to your front door, you know, temporarily, right. But they shut down a lot of other businesses as well. I mean, cannabis patients in the state had a lack of access because the the stores, the dispensaries in certain counties in the state were shut down. Like here in Fresno, where I live, there is no in-person dispensaries. All of them are delivery only, you know. So cannabis patients that don't have access to, you know, those facilities pretty much are being denied medicine. So there's a matter, there's a number of suffrage that comes along with the policy restrictions as well, the temporary ones. And of course, since they've been on the books this entire time, I say, why not just wipe them out entirely? You know, instead of increasing taxes, which they've done in the state here, why don't we eliminate those taxes, at least temporarily, like you said, to allow taxpayers to keep that money in their pockets to help their families, you know, especially when they're struggling to pay their bills and, you know, buy food now, since it's double, triple the price they used to pay before this whole pandemic began. So I think one of the best ways to stimulate the economy is, of course, to let people keep their own money in their pockets instead of putting it in governments.
Yeah, so we've always championed the idea that people know best how to spend their own money. People know best how to manage their own lives. People know best how to make decisions that impact themselves, how to better themselves, better their lives, and better their situation, because the reality is they care more about themselves than anyone else. And like, the reality is, no offense, Nick, but I care more about me and my family than I care about you and your family. So I'm going to make decisions that better and improve my life and my family before I make decisions that are going to improve you and your family. And I hope that you feel the same way. And I hope that you wouldn't then use government to try and improve somebody else's life at the expense of somebody you don't even know.
Exactly. I mean, I wouldn't want government imposing their desires upon me, just as I wouldn't want to impose my desires upon you. And like you said, I don't know how to run your life better than yourself. So as a public representative of you and that choice, that decision, I have to make sure policies reflect that. Unfortunately, we have lawmakers in the state and the governor that feels otherwise, you know, or else we wouldn't have these restrictions on our liberties. You have children now being told that they must wear masks in classrooms, and are even pushing forward with legislation to have them expand the vaccination laws in our state. I mean, even before the coronavirus crisis, we had laws in the state where children, as well as professionals, whether they be in the healthcare industry or educational, work in education, that they had to be fully vaccinated. And that meant being up to date with your flu shots at the time. So now they're trying to expand that to include also the mRNA COVID shots. So
The booster hell, as we're calling it, because we never know when it's going to end. And somebody pointed out to me the other day, is the funny aside, is like, it was no shock when they started to come out and said, you're going to need more boosters, because they marketed this as a vaccine with two shots, but it had four lines on the card. like
no comment there. I got a strike on YouTube for talking about all of this, and I want to prevent you from experiencing the same thing. So
yeah. Okay, so you have six platform planks on your website that you're running your campaign on. You have economic revitalization, criminal justice reform, homelessness, community violence, Phoenix Initiative, and the New Gold Deal. And the crux of the matter, the Phoenix Initiative is basically just a COVID recovery economic plank, which is an incredible COVID recovery economic plank. That's a really good idea, good moving forward. But the thing to me that sticks out is like your three planks that aren't economic. Your three planks that kind of deviate from what the Mises Institute, more Rothbardian and right-wing libertarians think of as the standard, the gold standard, economic recovery and deregulation. That's what libertarians always campaign on. That's what every libertarian has spewing out of their mouth at every moment, whether they're running as a Republican or running as a libertarian or as an independent. It's always deregulate, open the free market economy. What I really think is interesting is your criminal justice platform, especially in a state like California, where criminal justice is an actual major issue, where you have the history of Kamala Harris locking people up and using people for slave labor in the Californian prisons, where you have a three strikes law on the book, where people are oppressed by the system every day. And you yourself had a pretty unique story about that, about how you've been dealing with it.
Absolutely. I have an extensive history of experience with abusive police officers, which is why I do support criminal justice reform. And that's actually quite shocking for a lot of, people that consider themselves to be Democrats to hear, and even Republicans, since I'm a Republican, candidate. But with me, again, being a Ron Paul Republican, I focus on the true conservatism of the police force and the expansion of the police state and what it has done to be pretty much an aggressor for the state to impose their will upon us, free people, you know? And if you are out there exercising your freedom, even if it's just walking down the street, you should not be accosted by police officers unless they have a reason to do so. And in my case, that did not happen, and I ended up being awarded a settlement because of that. But that money came out of taxpayers' pockets. It's always a loss on the residents, the people, the hardworking people of this state, opposed to the individuals responsible. So we definitely need to make sure that our law enforcement is being held to a greater standard than everyone else. And and that's why we should be removing the police Bill of Rights, removing qualified immunity, requiring that they carry liability insurance. That way, if there happens to be any injury, personal injury or death at that officer's hands, that they themselves are responsible for that payment to the victim or the family of that victim, opposed to, again, taxpayers having to foot the bill like we always do.
Yeah, it's absolutely wild to think of that being remotely controversial. to someone like me, like, that shouldn't be remotely controversial. But then again, like, I live in a state where we've had landmark cases about filming police, where we've had libertarians get arrested and fight federal court battles about filming police and reasserting our right to film police in public at any time. But you're currently facing a big legal issue, something that maybe might be a hindrance to your campaign or getting elected if you were win, facing quite a few years in prison for what?
Recording in court, believe it or not. I was recording my own court case, and these were traffic cases, so it should be just like a fix-it ticket, but that's the thing, is every arraignment is the same, whether it's a traffic case or a criminal case, which is treated as, which is why you're asked, do you plead guilty or not guilty, and if you refuse to enter a plea, then, they force you to go to trial. And this actually happened last year. So I had a trial. I was on trial. I was facing 6 years. Thankfully, I was not charged so severely, but I was found guilty. And I was sentenced to 40 hours community service. I had to pay like $700 in fines. And spend a year on probation, which at this point should kind of be over with. So I'm in the free and clear at this point. Going into the recall election, I was looking at that possibility of facing 6 years in jail, county jail, for during a pandemic, over recording in court.
This should really just highlight the absurdity of the California criminal justice system. Like, because it wasn't like even a criminal case. It wasn't even a high profile case. It was a traffic case in traffic court you're filming. And I think people were forgetting, like, there is a judge in Rhode Island. He's a traffic court judge who has a TikTok channel and an Instagram channel where he posts funny clips and highlights from his courtroom every day. Yeah.
You know what's so sickening about what happened to me is they really got upset because I posted the video on YouTube and I have like over 30,000 subscribers and over 7 million views. The views came from viral videos of me, you know, challenging judges in court, or, you know, actually doing what I did, recording in court. So I have previous videos of me doing that, or me being pulled over by a police officer, or whatever the case may be. But they didn't like that I put this particular video online, and that's why they prosecuted me for it. And that, and I sued them, the Walking While Black. That was really what did it. So I believe that the district attorney and other prosecutors in Orange County at that time kind of had it out for me. And that's why I ended up getting charged with contempt of court, is what it was. But yeah, what's funny is they actually broadcasted my trial on YouTube while I was being put on trial for putting a video on YouTube. So you talk about hypocrisy, man.
There's a similar case that I've been following where it's a woman in, I think she's in Louisiana, and she has no stake in the case. She's just a family court reform advocate, and she spends all day during the lockdowns while she's had nothing else to do, trolling the internet to find publicly broadcast family court cases from different states and bringing them up and streaming them and doing commentary on them about how fucked up the family court system is and how they're stealing children from their parents without due process and due cause. And she stumbled upon a really intricate case in Texas, and so it was publicly broadcast, so on the state of Texas's Zoom YouTube channel. And so she started restreaming it and doing commentary along with it, and that started to go super viral, and people started sending emails to the judge complaining about it, and he issued a warrant for her arrest.
Are you kidding me? That's unbelievable. It's disgusting what's going on, and a lot of people don't realize how truly corrupt our supposed justice system is. I mean, for these people to be able to just abuse their power of authority and create arbitrary laws like this judge in this case, you know, it's completely unconstitutional, you know, and that's what they take an oath to uphold. You know, these are sworn officials to the Constitution, and if they're not upholding you know, the rights therein, then we, the people, have a grievance and we got to do something about it. I mean, if everything is supposed to be on the record anyways in a courtroom, then they shouldn't have any objection against us making our own personal record for it, you know, especially in this day and age when everybody has a cell phone and, you know, there's police officers, again, abusing their authority. And when that happens, they're able to help be held accountable because of that video. And a judge is no different. You know, they're an officer of the state.
So, and on a criminal justice line and just barreling down more into the criminal justice reform trajectory, I think one of California's biggest criminal injustices is, in my mind, or as an outsider looking in, one of the biggest public problems with California's criminal justice system is the mistreatment, misuse, and abuse of prison labor. Now, you're running for governor, the chief executive of the state, but it's historically and typically the attorney general who deals with the prison systems and these systems. What can you as a governor do in California to address the blatant systemic oppressive abuses of slavery in California's prisons?
Well, believe it or not, I actually am proposing total reform of our criminal justice system, including our prison system, which I would actually like to privatize. Our governor banned that in the state, but when it comes to our county jails, they're overflowing. Our governor was actually sued because of that. So when it comes to housing criminals, and recently he's went on a spree to just release as many different offenders as possible, even if they are violent offenders. And so their criminal history isn't even being taken into consideration, or else if it was, then they'd be properly imprisoned. Unfortunately, our governor has not taken such standards to do exactly that. And that's why we do currently have those serious offenders walking among us at this current time. But I feel like with a privatization of the prison system, we as a state would be able to then hold those prisons accountable. The Mary right now, the relationship, we all know it's corrupt. You know, those private prisons are now backing and even supporting some of these candidates that get into office and create the policies to, again, enable those private prisons to do even more of the private, what is it, abuse of that person's labor. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's why we have prisoners out there fighting some of these wildfires and dying, you know. But then if they happen to, you know, leave the prison system and get released, then now they're unable to get a job in the same, doing the same thing that they were just forced to do, you know. Or I would say, if anything, it doesn't seem like forced because they're all asked to do it. But when you're sitting in a prison cell, it's like, what better choice do you have? And then you're not paying them any wages. It's like slave wages. And you're not training these people the proper training. You're pretty much just giving them a bucket and an axe and saying, go out there and put the fire out, you know? So I believe, again, if there was a separation between the state and how it imprisons people, then there would be a greater responsibility on the state to then look over the conditions of those prisons. And if there happens to be a failure there, then guess who's really responsible? The state. Right now, we're using taxpayers' money to imprison nonviolent offenders, you know, serious offenders and the like. But when it comes to our criminal justice system, we have one that's really operating off of locking them up and throwing away the key simply so they can continue to make money. It's monetized, you know. Even a traffic violation, you know, if you want to call it that, because you're exercising your right to travel and you shouldn't have to obtain a permission slip from the government just to do exactly that. You know, so if I buy a car, it's my own personal property. I should be able to operate it, you know, and do with it whatever I choose, as long as I'm not harming anybody. Same as if I want to go and out fishing or, you know, use my firearm or whatever the case may be. I shouldn't have to get permission from the government to do so if, again, I'm not hurting anybody. If I do, there's consequences that comes with that naturally, you know? So for people to think that the laws are what prevent us from being violent with each other are absurd, because if that would be the case, we wouldn't have violent among us and people who abuse those existing laws even still.
So I waffle on it in the idea of private prisons versus public prisons. I'm not going to say you're wrong. I'm not going to say you're right, because I have changed my mind on this subject so many times. And I don't think there's even a consensus amongst most libertarians about whether or not prisons should be private or public, because we talk about privatizing everything, but then the reality sets in. Private prisons are a financial, you're creating a financial incentive for the imprisonment of other human beings. And I don't know how a private prison can operate unless it's paid by the state per prisoner on a per head per diem basis, or if they're allowed to use prisoner labor for profit. And that profit incentive and that profit motive will inherently incentivize private prisons to find ways around abuse laws and abuse prevention, and to structure and hide their abuse to maximize their profit and maximize their gain, or just create insurance or create financial systems where they don't care if they get caught, because the fine for getting caught is less than the profit they're making by doing it. And the reality is, the private prisons that we do have in this country utilize the fact that we don't have a truly representative democracy, or even a truly representative republic, in which our legislators bear responsibility to the people or bear responsibility for their actions, and they're usually for sale to the highest bidder. And these private prison companies and are giant mega corporations who have hired lobbyists to pay off legislators to create more crimes to incentivize the imprisonment of more people for their financial profit. And in fact, it's a matter of public record and known as fact that private prison lobbyists were behind many of the mandatory minimum sentencing laws that Joe Biden pushed into place when he was in the Senate.
Well, you just pointed out everything that had to, it stemmed back to government, those corrupt government individuals, right?
Right.
And that's the problem, is they're the ones propping it up and continuing. Like you said, these private prisons are pretty much hiring lobbying firms to go out and do their bidding and create a cozy relationship with these district attorneys, with these prosecutors, you know, and of course with the elected officials. So I would say, if anything, those fines need to be heftier, you know, those sentences for abuses, it needs to be there. It's not right now. It's pretty much non-existent. And if there were laws in the state that said, hey, if you are a private prison and you're going to be, you know, employing these individuals to do whatever the case may be, whether it's fighting fires or making clothes or whatever the case may be, you need to pay them a proper wage, you know. And I think right now, of course, with there being a argument over what that is with this $15 an hour minimum wage law that we have in the state, that hasn't benefited us in any way. But creating a trust fund for these individuals to where, when again, they get out of prison, you know, if they have a life sentence, of course, that's not going to happen. But some of these people have children, you know, other family members that they could create a trust fund for. So I think, if anything, the prisoners need to be protected like any other union and be able to have those union rights and be able to lobby themselves for whatever wages they feel like they should be able to get paid, they want to get paid.
Now, you say someone's in prison for life, they can't get out. That's not going to happen. Why not? You're running for governor. You have criminal justice reform is such a major part of your platform, and most of your proposals are incredible and great steps forward for criminal justice reform. Even if I disagree with private prisons, you've at least thought it out, which is something most Republicans who say private prisons haven't done. But why not look at retroactive sentencing reform? Why are a lot of these people in California who are in prison for life on the three strikes rule for nonviolent offenses? A nonviolent offense shouldn't have somebody in prison in the first place, in my opinion. A victimless crime shouldn't be putting someone in prison in the first place, but it is, and it does. I'm going to pop up your other screen. Well, why are we looking at people who are in prison for life on nonviolent offenses, keeping them there? Why not make it a priority, especially if prisons are overcrowded, to get them out?
I apologize. Say that one more time, because I was...
Why not make it a priority if our prisons are overcrowded, to do retroactive sentencing reform? To somebody who's in prison for nonviolent offenses under a three-strike law and there for life, get them out. Put them back to work. Get them back in the economy. Don't make them a burden on their neighbors. Somebody who's in prison for selling small amounts of marijuana 10 years ago when it was a felony, get them out. Put them back on the street. Get them a job in a dispensary. Why don't we look at retroactive sentencing reform to reduce the population? And I know you said you had an issue with Governor Newsom just letting people out willy-nilly, but that doesn't mean a serious review can't be done to let people out who don't belong there in the first place.
I completely agree with you. He hasn't done that over the people that have been put in prison over cannabis. And that's actually been a recent protest by activists here in the state, because those people are still in jail. Why hasn't he released them? And that's, like I said, there isn't any investigations being done, any type of queries or research into someone's criminal past or why they're in jail to begin with. And if the three strikes put them there and it was, offenses that were nonviolent, then that needs to be eliminated completely. So I completely support that. As governor, that is exactly what I would be making sure that state officials were doing. But retroactively making, or what'd you say, retroactive pay for them?
Retroactive sentencing reform. Just get them out. Yeah. As far as fair pay, I think the problem with fair pay in prisons is going to be a constitutional argument that the proponents of prison slavery are always going to have over us. And I think we do need an amendment to the U.S. Constitution to amend and change the text of the 13th Amendment, because while the 13th Amendment abolished slavery, it has a very specific exemption that says, unless you're currently in prison for committing a crime.
Yes, absolutely. The 13th Amendment definitely needs to be, nullified, I would say.
But I wouldn't go that far. We don't want full-blown slavery to be legalized.
Well, this is the thing, it doesn't really say that it abolishes slavery. If anything, if you read the text of it, it says it expands it. And that's why we're all tax slaves to the financial system, and we're treated by classification, a tax classification, white, black, all of that has to play into it also when you go into the looking into the history of its establishment, which is why, again, there needs to be a constitutional review by constitutionalists, a constitutional panel, which there hasn't been, I believe, since forever. Each state should have one, and we don't currently in California. But I believe that the reconstitution of the state would be necessary at some point. It's a matter of getting the people of California on board with that and having them understand why that would be necessary. And I think it comes first with an exposure of what the abusers of the Constitution have done under, the guise of that authority.
Man, definitely an interesting road to go down. I know the federal constitution, the difficulty of amending the U.S. Constitution is so difficult, people stop teaching it in some public schools, is just a flat out impossibility that we'll never see happen again in our lifetime, because we'll never get 2/3 of Congress to agree on something unless it's bombing somebody they don't like. But
well, we should have government in school anyway. If taxation was voluntary and parents were able to pay for whatever school directly, instead of here in the state, the state again, taking property taxes away from everyone, even if you don't have kids and they're not in school, or you have grown adults, as kids, then you're paying for a service that you're not even able to utilize. Why not let people again keep that money for themselves, to let them use it for whatever they need first and foremost? And for parents to make those direct payments, in which case now they have more authority over school choice and whatever curriculum those schools choose to teach.
So you mentioned property tax being the problem there. And I will agree, property tax is the problem with a lot of things. I think property tax is one of the most egregious taxes that exist, because property tax is a tax that says you don't own anything. Because if you don't pay your property tax, we're not only going to take your home, we're going to put you in jail for occupying your own property. And that's so egregious to me, because it's also the one property tax that you can't opt out of. Property tax, you cannot opt out of. Sales tax, I can engage in agorism. I can trade with friends. I can engage in local labor. I can buy things in secondary markets without paying sales tax. Income tax, I can work off the dollar. I can work for cash. I can work under the table. I can do voluntary contracts with friends for work. And I can not pay income taxes. Yeah. But property tax, even if I don't own property, if I'm renting from someone else, I'm just paying their property taxes. You cannot opt out of property taxes. It's the only tax that is truly compulsory, and you have no option to opt out whatsoever. Whereas the other taxes, the options to opt out might be really inconvenient or really burdensome and difficult for people, but they exist and they're possible. Now, another big platform plank you have is homelessness, which is a huge rising crisis in California. And I think property taxes contribute a huge deal to homelessness, especially when you have things like rent control in your major cities that don't allow landlords to charge appropriate rents for higher end apartments to cover their own property taxes, that you end up seeing no incentive to rent, no incentive for low income housing, no incentive for new development and new building, that you end up with skyrocketing homeless populations. Is maybe property tax reform a path towards solving homelessness, not just in California, but even nationally? I know I talked to Daniel Miller a couple of weeks ago. He's running for lieutenant governor in Texas. His main platform is secession. They're trying to get Texas to leave the union. I know there's a similar movement in California. I want your thoughts on that too. But they're working on a plan and a proposal that's already passed constitutional muster, that's already has sponsors in their state legislature, and is getting ready for implementation and study to abolish property taxes in California. Do you think that's in Texas? Do you think that's something California could follow suit on?
Absolutely. As governor, I actually plan on suspending collection of all taxes, including property taxes. It sounds absurd, and a lot of people are like, how can you do that? Because where would government get its money from? Government has tons of ways to make its money, and that's why I actually support providing offering naming rights to some of our state property.
The Larry Sharp plan.
Exactly. Actually, I said it before Larry Sharp. Okay. You know what? All right. you got that from me. But yeah, I said that I wanted to allow pretty much naming rights. You know, if it's a highway and it's the, you know, California Golden Gate Bridge, instead of taxpayers, again, getting taxed to death, even paying a toll just to go on the road, you know, let them have naming rights. And if they want to call it the Google Bridge or Verizon Bridge, whatever the case, Disneyland Bridge, don't matter. If they're paying the monthly maintenance, you know, and they're paying for use of that bridge each and every year. If they're paying $100 million, that money goes directly into the state's pockets, you know, and we'll be able to use that to pay for administrative services. That's pretty much all government should be, is administrative service for making sure that your rights and your freedoms are not violated. Right now, it's too damn big. It's in every damn thing. And so if we restrict it even just once, and that's what I want to show people for 4 years, I'm going to show you how government should operate. A smaller government, a government this big, you know, you're used to one this big, telling you everything that you can do, whether from sun up to sun down, from cradle to grave. I want to show you for once in your life, you have an opportunity to live as an adult responsibly, and government's job is just to make sure that you are able to do so, period.
And how do you feel about CalExit?
I support people that would like to see California be an independent state. And that's why I do offer a path to independence through my Gold New Deal. I would like to see California have its own source of power that's owned by the people of California. I would like, and that way they're never paying another electric bill again, you know, and we're getting paid for that power instead of having to pay foot in hand over hand just to do so, with PG&E and SoCal Edison having a monopolization over it, and that leading to wildfires and, you know, criminal charges against them for, you know, causing those fires. So it's irresponsibility on their part, and we can, again, make California an independent state.
So I spoke with Louis Marinelli a couple months ago. He's heading up CalExit. He's an interesting guy to talk to. And what blew my mind when I went into that interview is I went in with an assumption where I'm like, oh, I'm talking to somebody working on secession. They've got to be a libertarian. They're probably just another libertarian. And then I started talking to Lewis Marinelli. I'm like, we don't agree on a goddamn thing, anything, across the board. I'm like, huh. I'm like, the reality is, so secession's being pushed in California by people who aren't remotely libertarian. And the only thing that we'd agreed on is in secession and localization, where his blue was Sacramento sucks, but Sacramento sure is better than DC. And I'm like, wow, I can't even refute that.
Right. I do have a third house in Sacramento, pretty much that lobbyist arm. And, you know, they puppet all of the officials there. And it's similar to what we see in DC. But, I used to be a member of CalExit. I actually ended my relationship with them because of too much backstabbing, including by Lewis Marinelli. And I have a debate with him that went off the rails and shows a perfect example of that. But as far as, again, the people behind the goal for California independence, they are very wholehearted, you know, activists in that nature, and I support them in that endeavor. And as governor, I will do exactly that. There's even a push to create a 51st state, the Jefferson State movement, up in Northern California. There we go. See, I was just talking about
that. Rock read your mind in the chat. So.
Right? Yes, I definitely will. I actually spoke with State of Jefferson leadership members, and back when I was running for governor in 2018, and I was hoping that I would have had their support then, but they chose to back a Republican, you know, instead, because the idea is that a libertarian will never win. And unfortunately, that's the uphill battle that libertarians face in just changing people's psyche about the two-party system. They're so conditioned into thinking, I must vote red or I must vote blue in order to win. You know, They don't care about their rights. You know, if they really did, then you wouldn't see everybody galvanized behind statism. I mean, we're really seeing that both on the right and the left. You know, the right wants to say, oh, you're supposed to have medical freedom, but, you know, you shouldn't be able to abort a baby. You know, and the left is saying, I want to be able to put this in my body, you know, but yet at the same time, my body, my choice. And it's like, you can't have it both ways. And both of you want to use force, you know, the authorities to get your way. And it's like when the left does it, the right shames them, but yet they back the blue. And then now you have this, you know, what you were talking about happening in Canada, where you have the authorities out there. And here in America, you know, going out to eat at Applebee's and having, you know, restaurant goers being dragged out simply because they're not wearing a mask. When are we going to stand up and say enough is enough together, unified?
Heidi Briones, she's a former progressive candidate. She ran for Congress in Portland, Oregon, like super, super lefty progressive, who after COVID has started to lean more and more libertarian and realizing that government is the problem, and has become a really good friend of us. She said something a few months ago that really stuck with me. She's like, I don't think the partisan divide anymore is Republican versus Democrat. I do not think there exists a conservative versus liberal partisan divide anymore. The true new partisan divide is authoritarian versus individualist, where people who believe in individual liberty versus people who believe in collective responsibility. Mm-hmm. And me, you, her, Doc in chat, Pat in chat, people who watch this show, people who share our values are all in favor of individual liberty. We don't believe there can be a collective responsibility, because a collective can't be beholden to anybody, because it inherently oppresses the individual. Because if one individual disagrees, then the motives of the collective are oppressive to that individual, and it cannot go forward with that. So when you look at the question of what a libertarian can't win, and that's what keeps people from voting for libertarians, I don't think That is what keeps people from voting for libertarians. I think that's a large part of what keeps people from considering the potential of a libertarian in a race. But the reality is, and I've come to this conclusion after my years of being in the Libertarian National Committee, working within the Libertarian Party, and lobbying Liberty Republicans in New Hampshire, and working with Liberty Republicans in New Hampshire, and running as a libertarian, and working on other libertarian campaigns, and working on Republican campaigns. I think libertarians, people who share our values, are such a small minority of the population that it doesn't matter. If we were treated fairly by the media and we were put into the debates, libertarians have this mind-numbingly idiotic belief that if we just get in the debates and people hear our message, they'll vote for us because it's better. The belief that you can logic someone into understanding your values, as opposed to just campaigning to people who share your values, is something I think is a utter fallacy of politics that libertarians have boxed themselves into. And it's one of the reasons I respect the hell out of you, because you said, screw it, I'm running as a Republican. I need a chance to get my name out there and get my message heard by a larger number of people. And in the process, you're going to get a lot of low information, idiotic, dumb voters who vote for you just because there's an R next to your name. Yep. I hate to say it, you're going to get a lot of dumb, idiotic, low-information voters who vote for you because you're Black. Yeah. And you're going to get a handful of high-information voters, like a small number, who know that you're Libertarian and will vote for you anyways, even though you're running as a Republican. And that gives you a chance. Small number. But that gives you a chance to put your libertarian views and policies into effect. And that's the big identity crisis within the Libertarian Party right now, is where do we move forward? Like, do we hyper-focus on nonpartisan races where libertarians can have an active and immediate impact in the daily lives of their neighbors by getting elected to the school board or budget committee, and it doesn't matter that they're a member of the Libertarian Party? Or do we waste tens of thousands of dollars running somebody for U.S. Senate with a goal of winning the election and going to D.C., where even if lightning struck in a fucking bottle and you caught it and you won, you're now one of 100 with no influence and nothing to accomplish? Whereas here in New Hampshire, We have more libertarians in the state house in New Hampshire than are elected nationally elsewhere combined. It's just a lot of them have a little R next to their name.
Right.
And a good number of them are members of the Libertarian Party. They don't go around bragging about it and promoting that fact, but they just do the work and get liberty accomplished. And
exactly. That's all that matters, man. At the end of the day, I could give a damn if it was a Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, Independent, Green, whatever you want to call yourself. If you get in there and you do the job according to the founding principles of this nation and your oath of office, that's all I care about. And just know that I'm watching, you know, and that's what I want to let state officials know as governor. Is my job is to make sure you're upholding your oath. You violate that oath, then it's my job now, as you know, the executive chief of the state, you know, to now make sure that you're held accountable for your crimes. So that's a violation because it's called treason. You know, you have no oath of office at that point. And unfortunately, it's happened time and time again. We have a governor that feels like the Constitution doesn't apply to, you know, us as Californians, and his oath of office doesn't apply to him, as well as the parameters of that Constitution, you know. So if he's not doing his job accordingly and pretty much acting as a tyrant at this point, imposing mandates that he won't even follow himself, you know, what was it? He went out to the state championship game where the Rams were playing the 49ers, and he was there without wearing a mask. And right now in California, up until today, actually, we had a mask mandate that was extended over 2 months by his declaration. So we need to make sure that these people aren't abusing their authority and are being held accountable. So it starts first with the governor. If he can't do it, then who can we call?
All right. Hey, so before we run out of time, before we end the show, I got one final question for you. And this is a question from chat, question from a live viewer, Keith C. Governor, please define libertarian. Your own words and what it means. I'll expand on it. Define libertarian and tell everyone what liberty means to you.
To me, it's the live and let live. It's the golden rule of life that we all know, you know, and you shouldn't have to say that's libertarianism. That's just the natural law and order of who we are as human beings, you know. So if as long as I'm doing living my life and not doing anything to harm you, then and not violating that, you know, non-aggression principle, where, you know, I'm employing others to go out and do harm against you for me, then I should be left to be free to live my life as I choose to. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't believe even just that fundamental understanding and want to tell other people what they should do and how they should live their lives. So in that sense, that takes away their individual right to live freely, and you're looked at as being property of someone else. And if we're looked at as being property of the state, then we have to question what is the role of our government and what we should be doing about it as, you know, subjects of that authority. I don't think that's what the founders of our nation wanted. I think they wanted we the people to always be in power, which is why we should make sure that we're electing liberty-minded individuals, no matter who they are. If it's a R next to their name, or a D or L or G or whatever the case may be, make sure that you are properly vetting them and then giving them your support, you know. And of course, financial support helps, especially when you're a grassroots candidate. So donate, definitely.
thank you so much for coming on, Nick. This has been a great show. Apologize to everyone for the technical difficulties. And I don't blow it against Nick. It happened to me last week, and y'all still stuck through it. So you guys are great. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for watching. Thanks for commenting. Nick, where can people follow you? Where can people learn more about your campaign?
Right there, wildstar2022.com. Please definitely check it out. You can connect with me on Twitter as well, The Real Cue Ball. All my social media handles are right there on my website. And like I said, I'm a grassroots candidate. I could use all the help that I could get. I'm a thorn in the side of the Republican Party right now. And I need all the help that I can from the people all across the country. You know, even if you're not in California, you can support, you can make a financial contribution. Wildstar2022.com. Please donate whatever you can. Every little bit helps on a campaign trail. Right now, I'm actually trying to pay that damn near $4,400 filing fee just to get my name on the ballot. And I have up until Friday, March 11th to do so. So please check me out further. Check out my campaign platform. All of my pledges there as well. And hopefully I'll be able to gain your support.
All right. Hey, thank you everyone for tuning in. Thanks, Nick, for joining us. I'm looking forward to it. You, along with Larry Sharp and other great liberty candidates running across the country, are really giving me hope and a little bit of a white pill when I've been down on it for a few years. So thanks for doing what you do. Thanks for stepping up, and thanks for giving a voice to liberty in a hell hole such as California. Thanks for everyone for tuning in, and until next time, be free. Thanks again for tuning in and joining us tonight. Make sure you hit that like button and leave a comment below to let us know your thoughts. If you haven't subscribed, go ahead and hit that big red subscribe button on YouTube and turn on notifications to get alerted every time we go live. If you enjoyed this content, you can join our production team on Patreon by following the link in the description. And don't forget to follow on social media and join our community Discord channel by following the links in the description as well. The best part of all of this is the community that we're building and growing. So go ahead and join us. And thanks once again to our awesome sponsors and patrons for making all of this possible. And if you can't catch the show live, you can always catch it the next day on YouTube, Odyssey, Anchor, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Breaker, and wherever else you listen to your favorite podcast. So until next time, everybody, be free.